Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 142 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sarah Kamen.
On today's show, Ivan Orkin, ramen master of Ivan Ramen in Tokyo and here in New York City. Later in the show, we will TMA, The Morning After, quizify Ivan. We'll see how he does on that. But first, Miss Sarah Kamen, it's lovely to see you, and I know you have some food news.
I do. All right, first off, starting from the great state of none other than Texas, down in good old Houston, not to be confused with Houston. A man was kicked out of a restaurant for having facial tattoos.
Oh, that's just discrimination.
Well, of course it is. But the best part is it's not just any restaurant that this happened at. It was a so-called restaurant. Are you familiar with the term, Ivan?
I'm not, but it seems we're always making new words these days.
Well, it's a combination of breasts and restaurant, in case you didn't figure that one out yourself.
I'm not against that.
you get breasts on the menu
like
along with your
breasts?
Chicken
wings. Okay,
chicken wings and boobies kind of place. You know, Hooters might have been the original restaurant. So this guy walked in, and he was immediately escorted out because he had some tattoos on his face. And so not only was this place, it's called Bombshells. It's an army-themed, a military-themed, breast-themed restaurant. There are shots, like as in alcohol shots, on the menu called waterboarding and don't ask, don't tell. You can order that. I can't stop because it's true. And they kicked out a guy for having a tattoo on his face.
Well, yeah, they should be closed, not kicking out Tattoo Face Johnny.
I know. And poor Tattoo Face Johnny, I looked at the picture. He has like a couple dots on his face. He doesn't even have anti-USA propaganda or anti-breast sentiments on his face.
No, wait. Breast meaning chicken breast, right?
No. Like lady boobs.
Wow.
Yes. Okay. It's like the kind of place where waitresses wear tops, and I use that word loosely, that are rather revealing, and their pictures are plastered all over the menu, and there's certain uniforms that show a lot of skin, and that's why people go. It's not for the chicken breasts. No. It's for the waterboarding shots and the boobs.
Is it wrong that I want to go there once?
Yes.
And then I want to create a morning after boycott of Bombshells for all of our listeners there in Houston.
I think we can do that right now.
Okay.
First you have to go to Houston.
Yeah, I'm boycotting
it. I guess I'm never going there.
Yeah.
I'm not on the way to Houston.
Yeah, but this
soon.
This guy yelped about his experience, and there has been a lot of complaints. So don't go there, you guys, for this temptation.
Especially if you have tattoos on your face.
And especially don't do that. Okay. So weird.
Wow. That's a great story, Sari.
Thanks.
That makes my morning, I think.
Didn't make it up. Okay. I wish I did. Okay. Moving on. I don't know. Have you guys heard about this race together thing that's been going on at Starbucks? Have you heard about this?
You mean the way they're putting slogans on cups?
Yeah, exactly. So the CEO of Starbucks has invited his employees to write on a cup, hashtag race together before giving a customer their coffee. And that is, I guess, it's code. It's an invitation to saying, let's have an open and frank discussion about race relations right now.
Oh, I was thinking running race.
That would be better. No, it's
Hello.
Actually let's talk about race while I hand you your
with a hashtag.
Mocha, chica, fraca, shaka, laka, drink right now. So a lot of people are okay, that's great. And then other people are that's completely inappropriate. Having race discussions with your barista is totally out of context. It makes no sense. And it's trivializing the entire issue.
Are they handing a cup and being I am of German descent? What are they saying?
They're I would love to talk to you about how you feel about racial issues right now. And all I can think of is oh my God, that holds up the line. what about all the other people waiting, right?
Doesn't sound like it's going to work.
I don't know. A lot of people are pissed about it.
But also, like, think about the way you feel before you've had coffee. Like,
yeah.
And someone wants to do, like, a hard-hitting, you know, question with you.
Like, not racist, but, like, kind of angry in general.
Like, just don't ask.
Don't ask me that. I know. There were some really good tweets. I want to read my favorite tweet that someone wrote in response. Having to talk #racetogether with a woman in Lululemon pants while pouring pumpkin spice is just cruel. Says a tweeterer.
Oh, I like that tweeterer. I
think that sums it up.
Yep, 100%.
Okay. Lastly, Jess, this is for you. High levels of arsenic found in two buck chuck and other popular California wines. You heard?
Yeah. I mean, all I have to say is duh.
Why? I mean, arsenic.
It's cheap wine. Like, what there's going to be
mean it's going to be
all
poisonous.
Sorts of chemicals in there. Of course, there's going to be crap in there, like arsenic. I mean, they said that there's arsenic in our drinking water, like certain levels of it. So,
right.
It's, you know, I don't know if it's from the water or if people are just
well, that was
a little
the,
rat
that was the backlash. People are like, well, there's arsenic in water.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. I was going to say, you
make
don't
it
need
okay.
to drink it. No.
Yeah.
I mean, I honestly, I think that these producers like Franzia and Ménage à Trois.
Ménage à Trois, no.
Yes. No. Ménage à Trois. And I can't remember the other one off the top of my head.
Two Buck Chuck, Ménage à Trois, Moscato, and Franzia. White Grenache, ooh la la. among others that I guess weren't named in this particular article. They tested more than 1,300 bottles of wine and was shocked to discover they had some very high levels of arsenic, which can be incredibly harmful to humans.
Duh. I mean, the lesson learned, Sari, is just don't drink cheap wine.
Dude, I don't.
I don't think you do, but I'm saying it to the masses
I don't think
there.
Any of our listeners would or do. And now they definitely won't.
You know, I have been known to drink some Vendage Sauvignon Blanc at a barbecue in Huntington Beach, California.
Every
once.
Now and then, I know you to slum it a little bit.
I'm okay with that.
Okay, just be careful.
I will. I will test my blood levels for arsenic.
Okay.
I'll be careful.
No dying on the morning after, especially at the hand of wine.
Oh, yeah, not allowed.
Not allowed.
Not allowed at all.
Okay.
That was great news.
Wow.
I don't
thanks.
Know where I've been. I mean, I definitely heard that story, but the other two were just...
Well, I've missed you.
I've missed you too, Sari.
I mean that.
Let's take a break here. We're going to come back with Ivan Orkin of Ivan Ramen.
Yay.
Are listening to Knife Show. This is The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network.
And we're back here on The Morning After. A self-proclaimed Japanophile, Ivan Orkin, from Long Island originally, opened a ramen shop in Tokyo and earned the Japanese seal of approval, becoming one of the most popular ramen shops in Tokyo. Now he has two Ivan Ramens here in New York City. Welcome to The Morning After, Ivan Orkin.
Hello.
So nice to have you here.
Yeah, it is. It's lovely, sunny Brooklyn.
Yeah. Finally. Exactly. Radio listeners can't see that, but...
They know it.
It's true. So I guess what started your love affair with Japan in general?
I got a job at a sushi bar in 1978, washing dishes.
What was a sushi bar like in 1978?
It was one of the first ones.
It was out in Long Island?
It was out in Long Island, in Syosset, Long Island, right in town, next to the train station. And I got $5 off the books, which back then was quite a bit of money. I don't know. I took to it the minute I walked through the door. I've always had sort of this weird love affair with food, and I grew up with a mom who had an anti love affair with food. I've always sort of had this. I always had this thing about food, and when I got this was sort of my first real job. And you got to eat, which was cool. And so I would go into work from school. I'd ride my bike after school and to start, and I would sort of wash all the dishes from their, you know, from their prep, and then, you know, start, you know, and then we'd have family meal. And I wrote about this in my book, but there was a funny, you know, my favorite story, one of my favorite memories was of, you know, going to work after school and being really, really hungry, and, you know, saying to the chef, you know, I'm just famished. You know, and he grabbed a bowl and he cracked an egg and he poured soy sauce into it and he whipped it up into a crazy froth and he poured it over a bowl of hot rice and sprinkled seaweed on top and he sort of gave it to me and I was like, ooh.
What are these flavors?
And my recollection is that while it was a little slimy, I really liked it. And maybe it was some sort of indoctrination, because after that, I was sort of in. And the guys were really nice. They were the nicest people. And I would sit down with them every day, and we would eat, you know, the leftover scraps from cleaning the fish, and we'd eat raw tuna, and we'd eat, like, the hearts and livers and squid guts and all kinds. And I loved all of it, and I really was into it. And I worked there for about a year. And it's funny, because from that on, I was just a hardcore sort of a sushi lover. So whenever my parents would take us out, I'd always say, oh, can't we get sushi? And on my birthdays, I would always ask to go to the sushi place. And, you know, my parents would say, well, why don't you get the sushi deluxe? And I'd say, Mom, I order by the piece.
Is that like a faux pas if you order like sushi deluxe?
No, not at all. But, you know, I think that the rhythm of sushi is better experienced by ordering it a little bit at a time. So then you get, you know, I think the style of eating in Asia in general, but in Japan, is that a lot of restaurants are really sort of there's a real collaboration between alcohol and bites. And, you know, you order a few things, you eat them, you sip whatever you're drinking, and then you chat and you have this nice flow. Whereas, you know, I've always sort of felt like sometimes Western dining is, you know, you chat, you get food, you stop talking, you eat, then you come up for air and you talk more and it's cleared and you get the next course. And not always. And I think now that small plates are becoming a very important part of our dining culture, it's changing. Certainly at my restaurant, but I think that when you think about it that way, it's really cool that, you know, rather than getting this one platter of fish that they made them all and put them all on one plate, you know, you get a piece, you eat it, you contemplate its texture and flavor, and then you say, okay, you know, now I'll have, you know, yeah, this and that.
I imagine you're really savoring something more if you're not already anticipating what your next bite is.
Yeah, and I've always mostly sat at the counter, and if there's another counter seat, I eat something else.
Yeah, my family's approach when I remember when the first sushi restaurant opened in Cleveland, Ohio, in the 90s. And I remember my family's approach was ordering one of those boats.
Sure.
It was like a wooden boat just stacked with sushi. And it was like, okay, ready, set, go.
Yeah,
and
attack.
Attack. And it was like, who could get the most sushi?
Yeah.
Where, yeah, we're not Japanese. Yeah.
So then you ended up moving to Japan in the 90s, correct?
In the 80s.
In the 80s.
So, when I finally I left and I did other jobs, and that was job lasted about a year, but the experience of the people really stayed with me. So when I went to college, I still hadn't fulfilled my foreign language requirement, and so I decided I'm going to look for a college that offers Japanese. So the only schools I applied to were schools that had a Japanese program.
Was that hard to find?
In 1983, it was. Yeah. I mean, not impossible, but, you know, the best schools had it, you know, but I wasn't going to get into Michigan or Berkeley or Harvard, you know. But Boulder had one, and so did the University of Arizona, which were the two schools I applied to. One, both like beautiful places. One was sunny and warm. One was like gorgeous and wintry. And, you know, I had heard that Boulder was one of the most beautiful places in the country, and I just thought, you know, I'm not ready to go to California yet, which is weird. It's almost sort of like a weird Grateful Dead thing. Like, I didn't want to go to California just because I love the
totally
Grateful Dead.
Boulder's close enough, though.
Boulder's close enough. And so I chose Boulder, and I just ended up becoming a Japanese major and everything, you know, language. And I studied ancient poetry and modern literature and history and that whole thing. And I really loved it. And so when I graduated, I, like most undergraduates, you don't know what the heck you want to do with your life. So I thought, well, if I spend 4 years studying a foreign language, I guess the next step is to go live in that country. So that's how I ended up in Tokyo in 1987.
And so, I was reading some of your introduction of your book today, and it was really interesting to read you just describe yourself in like a very self-deprecating way at that time.
That's Jewish.
I can relate. but at the same time, like, to me, it just struck me as such an achievement that you were able to just go to school and pick up Japanese. I mean, that in itself is pretty extraordinary.
I suppose. I mean, listen, it's been a lifelong process. I mean, I'm 51 and I've been speaking Japanese or studying it for, you know, 30 years. So I opened a business and did it myself in that country without using any English. So it's gotten better and better and better over the years. I mean, I just had lunch with one of my good friends from college days, and she was also a Japanese major, and she's a university professor in Japanese. But I said to her, I mean, I have not studied Japanese since I graduated college. I mean, I don't write down vocabulary. I don't, you know, although I'm about to take a challenge. Because my reading and writing has really slipped over the years. And so I've decided that I'm going to finally become fluent in reading and writing. So I'm like sort of gearing up. And I'm trying to think about how to have it be this sort of a public enough thing so that if I don't do it, I'll be embarrassed.
Jesse, what's on that TMA quiz you got there?
It's not Japanese.
Oh.
But, okay. But I think he just said that publicly he is going to be studying, like relearning the language.
So. I need to be able to read the
feel
paper.
Feel free to do it on our radio show.
Yeah, I think he just did.
That's
yeah,
right.
I think
that's right. I got to throw down the gauntlet, you know.
Yeah.
So then you end up opening a ramen shop in Tokyo, and did everyone think you were kind of crazy to do that?
Yes.
I think you are.
Did you think you were kind of crazy?
I didn't.
Well,
but I think everything I do is good.
Once again, Jewish.
It's funny. People would say it's so amazing that you could do something like that.
Or it's very unlikely.
But to me, you know, I had been living in Tokyo already for, you know, 3.5-4 years. And my wife is Japanese and my children are half Japanese. And we lead a very sort of interesting hybrid lifestyle. You know, we speak both languages at home. We watch, like, you know, both types of television and both types of music. And, you know, my brain is very a mishmash of both languages and cultures. So to me, opening a business in Tokyo, while it was challenging, and I knew there was a whole hook in there and the white guy doing ramen and all that. But I guess at the end of the day, as far as I'm concerned, I belong in Tokyo. And anybody who says I don't, you know, they can go where, you know, where. So to me, it's like, you know, when to me, doing that made sense. While it was, of course, a challenge. And then, of course, I had the other thing to fall back on. Whereas if I failed, it's like, of course you failed. You know, you're a white guy trying to open a ramen shop in Tokyo, you know. So it was kind of a cool project to choose, you know.
And then at what point did you go to cooking school?
Well, I went to cooking school in 1991. Or 90 or 91, I don't remember.
Did you open your shop first?
No. I'm a Japanophile turned chef, you know, so I've always loved food. And then, you know, and then I discovered this love of Japanese, and I've sort of, it's been this sort of lifelong growing passion. And I'm not really a Japanese geek. I mean, I don't like do manga, and I don't study, you know, traditional Japanese architecture or anything like that. I mean, I you know, I just, something about the culture. I mean, I think I'm probably Japanese, yeah, you know, at some point in a former life. And so I feel there's just this very warm affinity I have for the country. And I don't think of myself as Japanese. I just think that I belong there when I'm there. Hmm. So, you know, I ended up going to cooking school after doing a bunch of jobs that sucked and that I didn't like. And my Japanese wasn't good enough and I wasn't geeky enough to become, you know, a Japanese professor or go work at Dentsu, the advertising company. That wasn't what I was. It was never white collar, and I wasn't academic. Mm. So I didn't know what to do with my language skills. So I sort of left Japan after 3 years. I said, you know what, I don't know what to do with this. I got to go. And then after like some agonizing in my late 20s, like, oh my God, I'm in my late 20s and I don't know what I want to do, which, you know, I mean, nowadays I think you get a little more slack, but, you know, in my generation, I think when you're 29 and you still haven't decided what you are, I mean, you're starting to be like a loser, you know? And I think I realized, hey, you know, I love food and maybe it's time to do something about it. And so I went to the Culinary Institute in Hyde Park. It was a good time to go. It was still kind of hardcore. It was, you know, it was becoming a big business, the cooking school thing, but it was right when there still weren't a lot of cooking schools. It was, the teacher could still hit you, you know?
Yeah, so it was all like pirates, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the chefs smoked cigarettes in the kitchen, you know, it was just, you know, it was still a little bit cowboy. And you still needed real balls if you wanted to make it in the kitchen. And it was, it's still sort of so these days, but there was a lot more honor and there was a lot more sense of sort of the craft, I think, you know, when I first started. It was a good time, I think, to come up, you know, especially because when I came up, it was sort of the cusp of the world thinking that, of course, no one can cook in America. There is America's French fries and pizza and burgers and milkshakes. The French make real food. And that's my generation when, you know, I worked for Bobby Flay, who was, you know, one of those guys who said, you know, we actually make real food, homegrown food, really great food. And, you know, Larry Forgione and Charlie Palmer and, you know, all these guys who really finally said to the world, hey, you know, we can cook. And now, of course, people copy us. But so it was a very interesting time to start cooking, you know.
I've always been a very big fan of ramen, but I actually have no idea as to like the origin of it, or specifically if there is one, you know, one original way to make it, and then there have been like offshoots from there.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a Chinese dish. I mean, I think it's, you know, it came into Japan, you know, many hundreds of years ago, but it didn't really catch on until the turn of the 20th century. And then I don't think it really became what it is that you see now until the late 90s. You know, it was always sort of a street food, a kid's food, a blue collar worker's food. You know, you wouldn't see a pretty woman in a nice dress eating in a ramen shop. Most of them were pretty gritty. And I think that in the late 90s, this ramen boom sort of started, and it started to pick up speed. And when I came back to Tokyo in 2003, so I was always, you know, I lived in New York. I lived in Japan for a couple of years, moved back for like 13 years. And over those 13 years, I could find pretty authentic sushi bars, and you could find like izakaya and like sakagura, where you go into the basement. It's like being in Tokyo, and you're drinking sake. That's really pretty good, and you could find your Japanese vibe back in the 90s. But there was no ramen, you know. Like Sapporo served a bowl of ramen, but even it was only okay, and it wasn't a ramen shop vibe. And so I really missed ramen, and so there was this aching desire to eat ramen for years and years and years. So when my wife and I moved back, it was like this, the ramen boom was now starting to pick up speed, and there was more and more like ramen magazines, and all these chefs were on these variety shows and talking about their ramen. So it was a very cool time, and we were eating ramen like crazy, you know. I would drive, and she would have her little flip phone, and she would have this thing called the Ramen Navi. It was a little, it was like a ramen navigation app. and you could find ramen shops. So I would shoot, oh, I turned, you know, this was also before you had the car navigation. So we'd have like, wow. You know, she'd have like a map on her lap. And then the thing open, and she'd be like, turn left, turn right here, you know, go down this road. And then there'd be like a line of 30 people. She'd, that's the place. And we'd park and we'd go eat ramen. And that's sort of how it started when we went back, that we were just eating a ton of ramen. And I had never thought about having a ramen shop once in my life. I mean, it's like, it's funny because some people interview me and they say, so you went to Japan and, you know, you studied with the ramen masters for 10 years and then you fulfilled your dream of having a ramen shop. And I'm like, no. Not really. I was a stay-at-home dad, and my wife was like, you know what, you're irritable and you're sitting like watching downloaded episodes of Grey's Anatomy, and it's time for you to like do something, maybe, you know.
And if you make your own ramen, we won't have to wait in line.
That's right. So it just sort of happened like that. It was just like, you know, I needed a job. I didn't really want to work for anybody anymore. I just was no longer down with working in a restaurant and having a boss. And so I kept saying, what should we do? I wanted to have a sandwich shop, but, you know, and then I wanted to have, we talked about a bunch of different options. My wife kept saying, do a ramen shop. It's a great idea. There's no American guys doing a ramen shop. It's a great hook. It'd be really fun.
Were you not like, for good reason, there's no American guys doing ramen in Japan?
Yeah, well, yeah. I was like, how the hell am I going to learn how to make ramen? She's like, you're a really good cook. You'll figure it out. And I was like, I don't know, you know. And even though I'm really not shy when you know me and when I'm talking, but I'm actually can be quite shy. And like the idea of asking, you know, a guy just going into a ramen shop and saying, hey, would you know, let me work here? And I knew how mysterious the shops were. So I knew that it wasn't going to be like, hey, sure, come on in. You can stay here for however long you want and I'll show you everything. It doesn't really work that way. So I knew it was going to have to be like a 1 or 2 year commitment. And I, quite frankly, I mean, I've been cooking for 15 years and I didn't want to do a 2 year apprenticeship, you know, and I needed a job and I wanted to make money. And so I said, you know what, I'm just going to sort of figure it out myself. That and a 6 day class on ramen making that I like dug up like in the middle of, you know, Japan somewhere. And then I sat at home making ramen and just sort of playing around.
The traditional ingredients that go into a bowl of ramen, I guess I'm thinking like pork broth, right?
No, it doesn't have to
be. So
mine isn't,
really can't
right?
Be
so mine's not pork broth. Here in the States, for whatever reason, you know, the Southern style, the Kyushu style white pork broth has become very popular. It's very clean, you know, it's the Ippudo style that a lot of people know about. I never, you know, when I went to Tokyo, you know, just like, look, I mean, heavy flavored things tend to get very popular because they're easy to understand. They have a big umami kick. It's you know, it's just fun to eat. But I tend, you know, I came up through more fine dining. I tend to like refined cooking more and refined flavors more. So I would eat these heavy bowls of ramen, which I liked and I still like. But I always feel pretty crappy afterwards. You know, I'd be either really sleepy or I would have a terrible stomach ache or I wouldn't be able to eat anything for like 14 hours afterwards. I'd be bloated. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is not good. It's not like a diet thing. It's just like wrong to not want to eat until tomorrow, you know. And then one day I went into a shop where they did more of the style I ended up doing, which was a double soup, which was a dashi broth made from kombu and smoked dried fish. And then chicken soup or even a light pork soup, but blended together. So the broths were much, much lighter. I didn't feel as tired and burnt out after eating it. And the flavors were sort of shinier to me, and I was really into it. So
all your broths are half dashi.
Yes, the Ivan Ramen signature. Not necessarily, because uh-huh. I still do. I'm a chef, and I do whatever I want to do. So, you know, but my signature Shio and Shoyu Ramen are a blend of dashi and chicken and whole chicken soup. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, I've done maze men, which is noodles with much less broth. It's almost more like a pasta vibe. I'm going to be doing a late night tonkotsu, which is going to be, and it's going to be like really like over the top, fatty and rich with chunks of pork fat floating in it, and that's coming up next week
at
Slurp Shop for Passover. Yes, for Passover. Although we are going to have a Passover friendly ramen for the week of Passover. We have gluten free noodles and no pork, and so you can get your ramen thing going on without desecrating the Passover vows.
Okay, well, before we get to kind of like what's coming up next and all that, I just want to hear a little bit about like the great success that happened in Japan and like how that happened so surprisingly quickly. And then also a little bit about the backlash in terms of like what happened in Japan, if there was any, and then same with New York. I mean, there's been so many conversations revolving around like, oh, this white chef's doing Mexican food and this, you know, Korean chef is doing Chinese, and sort of like where you see yourself fitting in and what does authenticity mean to you? And I know it's kind of like a loaded question, well, but
it's like 7,000 questions.
Those were 7,000 questions.
You got them all?
I'll try.
Yeah. I'll shut up. And
well, listen, you know, I mean, I I'm not stupid, and I knew that an American, and also ramen is very sticky. So it's you know, the ramen shops that are most popular in Japan, you know, they have some kind of theme or some kind of shtick or some kind of thing that hooks people. I mean, it can just be the food, but a lot of times it's a charismatic owner or really fun, you know, decor or really amazing soundtrack, whatever it is. You know, the really popular shops usually have some kind of cool groove going on. And our shop's got a cool groove going on. It's fun, except that we played a lot of Grateful Dead. But besides that, you know, it was
fun
very,
for some people.
Fun for some people, and for the crazy people who don't like them, they have to suffer. But all jokes aside, we had that fun stuff, and I had the white guy hook. But I also made good food. And in the beginning, you know, I'd have people come in and be like, oh boy, you know, there's a white guy. I would have people that would slide the door open, look in, and walk out. I've had it kind of all started when my wife sent an anonymous email to the number one ramen blogger and said, hey, I just ate a bowl of ramen at this new shop and the owner is a white guy. It was pretty good. That's all she wrote. And the next day he was there.
Did you just out her?
No, I've already told the truth.
Okay.
But he, and it's funny because I interviewed him in the book. In my book, and I asked him about this. I said to him, what was going on through your mind?
Yeah.
And he said, well, I got off the train and I'm walking to get to your shop. And he says, I'll be honest, I was writing your terrible review in my mind.
I bet a lot of people
as
were,
I was
were
walking
ready
there.
For you to fail.
But then when he said it came in and the kitchen was super clean because I'm an old fashioned guy and kitchens can't make good food if they're not clean. So it was shiny and clean. And, you know, we were using our noodles that we made in house. And I was heating my meat, which was sort of a new thing that a lot of people don't do, and to keep everything hot. And they really liked the ramen. And so he wrote in his blog the next day that Ivan Ramen is delicious and everybody should go. And it sort of just started kind of speeding up from there. And it was cool. And I've had plenty of naysayers. I still have naysayers. I mean, I had a guy when I opened Slurp Shop like the first week or two, and he told me I went up politely to a group and I said, hey, how's everything going? And this guy goes, oh, it's good. And he goes, tell him the truth. It's fucking horrible. And I was like, oh, really? He goes, yeah, I've been to Japan. I know. I've been there and I know. And this is crap. And I was like, okay, well, you know, and I don't fight with customers. So,
did you know you were the chef?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
And that you have a shop in Japan.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, someone who would say that and know, you know, to me it's like, I love criticism. That's good criticism because I don't think I'm perfect at all. And I know I've made mistakes. And, you know, if someone says I went there and the waitress was really rude to me and the food was ice cold and the table was sticky and dirty. And I mean, then it's like, oh, my God. You know, I'm on the phone. I'm in the restaurant. I'm fixing things. I'm checking. How can I make it better? And that does happen. And I love the. I mean, I'll take 100 of those. I'd rather not have 100. But if there's a problem, I want to know because that shouldn't happen. But most of the negative things you hear are angry people who have nothing better to do with their time. And you know, to tell me I'm not legitimate or whatever, it's like, okay, I don't know.
Sure, every chef gets that.
Everybody, yeah. And you know, it's. You know, I don't know what authentic means. I mean, I've decided what I think ramen is, and I stick really close to my version. But it's my version, and, you know, I've said, you know what, I at Ivan Ramen, I'm an expert. And I would never claim to be an expert anywhere else, yeah. You know, but at Ivan Ramen, it's my place, I built it, I know what's going on there, I make all the rules, so.
Have you legally changed your last name to Ramen?
I have not.
Yet.
I have not, no.
where do you think New York is at this point in terms of, like, reaching peak ramen saturation levels?
Oh my, it's not even close.
Okay.
What do you mean? There's, like, no ramen shops here.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't know, in Tokyo, there's, like, 8,000.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
No, that's
it's,
I'm glad. It's good to hear that. Healthy, I mean, I competition is always good.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's there's so much room, and it's just starting, really. You know, there's a, you know, for every person you talk to who says, "Oh, I love ramen," there's got to be 50 people who've never had it yet, and they've only heard about it, and or more. You know, it's not, it's still sort of a new food that you kind of need to be a little bit in the know, and you know what happens with these things is people see them and they'll say, "Oh yeah, I saw another article about this thing called ramen. You know, we got to go try it." And so I think it's becoming popular and a little bit more and more. I don't know what the saturation level will be. I mean, gosh, I mean, I, you know, 30 years ago, you could have said the same thing to me about sushi, right? Or 40 years ago, whatever it was, when I first started working. And, you know, in 1978, if I told you that people in middle of America would pick up a clamshell of California roll to take home to or to eat at the office, you'd say, that's crazy, no way. But, you know, people, sushi has become American. I mean, almost everybody. And there's still, you'll find someone every once in a while says, yeah, I just can't do the raw fish. And those people still exist. But people have almost completely have bought in the idea of a rice sandwich.
Do you still find people thinking that ramen is top ramen? Do you encounter
I
that
do,
at all?
And the funny thing about it is that I never ate it.
What's
I mean,
top
I,
ramen?
You know, instant ramen, the brick of
like, oh, it's like a
college.
Brick of noodles.
Yeah.
You just call it college. Drunk in college. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I never, I mean, I sort of gave up instant fast food when I was in my teens, and I never ate it again. So I don't, you know, to me, people say, oh, it's just like the top ramen. And I'm like, I guess I never ate it.
No,
I mean,
no, it's
I
nothing like top ramen.
No, it's nothing like top. But no, I mean, but you know. And I get that question a lot, and it always makes me kind of chuckle because it's like, I mean, there's just anything. I mean, you could say, you know, do you want to have, you know, a Keith McNally black burger for $22? And what's the difference between that and you know, a McDonald's, you know, quarter pounder with cheese? And it's like, do I even really need to answer the question? It's silly.
Yeah.
You know, so to me, it's all the same. There's all different, you know, price points, and there's all different kinds of things. And you know what? Sometimes you might say, you know what? I'm drunk as hell and I want to eat top ramen because that's what I'm in the mood and I love that. And there'd be nothing wrong with that answer. It's,
yeah.
You know, it's different.
What are your feelings on that kind of culture? Like that, not that ramen is necessarily street food, but I would call it, I don't know, kind of humble food that's had sort of,
well, you know, to me, ramen
beginnings, I guess, but that kind of like elevation that happens and then it becomes sort of haute cuisine.
Well, see, I feel like ramen is a massively elevated food stuff to me. It's terribly underpriced. I know all of you who think it should be still be $6 like it is in Tokyo in the most depressed economy in the world, practically. You know, it's an incredible slow food process. It's much different than its Chinese counterpart. And I love Chinese noodles, but they're really different. You know, they're really simple. The broths they make in a Chinese restaurant, like a really simple chicken broth that they make in a wok, and it's fast. And they pour it over some noodles with a little bit of scallion garnish, maybe a sprinkle of sesame oil or whatever. But it's super, you almost never get a complex bowl of Chinese, you know, noodles when you're having that kind of thing. And the ramen has just been, it's gone through this incredible evolution over the years, over and over again. And even like if you hang out in Tokyo as much as I do, you know, you can see like every year there's a new theme and there's like a new style. And like this year is potage and everybody was making these soups thickened with potatoes and corn and mashed vegetables. And then the next year was the year of beef ramen and everybody was making like beef bone ramen. And then like every year it's, and a lot of it's getting almost invented by the ramen writers, but it's just the way they talk about all these evolutions it's cool. I mean, it's interesting,
yeah,
but it really has become this incredibly complex, sophisticated thing.
I mean, there's so many components to ramen. I keep thinking like you were thinking about opening a sandwich shop, and in a way, sandwiches are kind of like ramen. There, you can add so many components, you can call it so many different things, but it's still a sandwich and it's still ramen.
If you want to break it all the way down, I mean, when you're as a chef might look at things, to me, all food is the same. So when someone said to me, "Oh my God, you like you worked at Lutèce and now you have a ramen shop," I'm so sorry to hear about your failure, and you know. But it's, you know, to me, it's like, to me, there's just good food and bad food. And you know, a properly made plate of food. You know, ramen's really no different than a nice plate of food you get in a French restaurant or in an American restaurant, whatever it is, right? You have garnishes that make sense, and you go to some restaurants where the garnishes make no sense. And, you know, there's a big chunk of carrot and broccoli, and you're like, well, did you have a reason to have that chunk of broccoli on there? I mean, or do you just like the way it looks? You know, it doesn't enhance the dish. So, or maybe that's just the level to where I think about cooking, but you know, a good plate of food has balance and it makes sense. And you know, you've thought through it and thought about how that sauce and that protein and that starch or vegetable or whatever kind of things you put on that plate and how they work together. And ramen is the same. You know, there's a certain balance between the noodles and the soup and the fat and the flavorings and the toppings. And the best bowls of ramen, they slurp well. You try to slurp them and they slurp right up, and you have a big, super flavorful mouthful of wet noodles in your mouth, and the toppings don't interfere with the noodles and all those things, and it works like that, you know. And it's no different than going to a nice restaurant somewhere or having a good hot dog. Mm-hmm. I've had bad hot dogs where like the toppings make no sense. There's too much of it. The bread's too soft. You know, the whatever sauce they put on made the bread wet. And I mean, you're like, why would you do this to a hot dog? You know, so it's really not that much different, right? I mean, you could have a bad hot dog, and I tell you what, a bad hot dog bums me out just as much as a bad meal at a 4-star restaurant.
Totally agree. And now I'm starving. By the way, Ivan, where are your shops in New York City so that anybody listening can check them out?
My main shop is at 25 Clinton Street between Stanton and Houston on the Lower East Side. Closest is the Essex Street, Delancey Street station. And the other one is on 45th and between 44th and 44th on 11th. It's in the Gotham West Market. And it's a very fun place. You can have Wi-Fi and toilets and tapas and beer and blue bottle coffee and tacos.
What else could you possibly want for?
I have to tell you something. As a lifelong New Yorker, even though I took 10-15 years off in Tokyo, you can never find a toilet. So any place that's got a toilet for me gets it at a full extra star. And then it's got Wi-Fi, so you can add another half or another full star to that. So it's, I don't know, that's how I see New York sometimes, you know.
Toilets and ramen.
I'm moving in. That's it.
We're going to take a break here on The Morning After, and we're going to come back with the Morning After quiz. Listening to Knife Show on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, what's up? This is John Norris, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
And we're back here on The Morning After. We've been talking with Ivan Orkin of Ivan Ramen about ramen, but now we're going to talk about something completely irrelevant to his life. So Ivan Orkin is your last name, a name in which you share with a very famous company, Orkin Pest Control.
I wish.
So, Mr. Orkin, we want to know what you know about Orkin. It's time for the Morning After quiz. You ready?
Sure.
Three questions, all multiple choice. No pressure, but no one's ever gotten them all right.
Okay.
So there's a first for everything, right?
You go for it.
All right, here we go. Founded in 1901 by Otto Orkin, what was Orkin Pest Control's original name? Is it A, Orkin the Rat Man, B, Orkin the Critter Killer, or Otto Orkin's Poisons?
Oh, no, I'll say three.
You say 3C.
C.
Otto Orkin's Poisons. No, actually, it was Orkin the Rat Man.
Nice. Oh, gross.
Nice.
Yeah, he was like a kid, like a farm kid, and his parents were like, can you figure out how to kill the rats in the barn so that you have some use in our lives?
It doesn't sound like he kills rats. It sounds like he is a rat.
It was 1901. Oh. So I don't think they.
It was before
they had
the
that.
Internet.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So question two: during World War I, Orkin was able to get the government to declare pest control as one of two service industries essential during wartime. Which is the other service industry that was deemed essential? Is it A, dry cleaning service, B, mortuary service, or C, beer brewing?
I don't know. Mortuary service.
Yes, mortuary service.
It was wartime.
Yeah, it was wartime. Well, but it was also more about, like, if your, you know, family member dies, like, we're still going to provide the, you know, the manpower and the
chemicals.
Exactly, and the chemicals and all of that to mortuary service. Anyway, all right. Question three, the final question. In the 1950s, Orkin moved its in the 1950s, Orkin moved its advertisements to television. Their commercials featured their mascot, Otto the Orkin Man. What was Otto? Was he a clean-cut reformed rat? You know, like, was like, no, didn't want to be a pest anymore. Is it B, an anthropomorphized pesticide can? Or is it C, a skull and crossbones?
I'll say B.
Yes, B, an anthropomorphized pesticide can.
That was from memory, by the way.
You remember this?
Sure.
Wow. Was it like...
I'm old.
And the spray can like danced around and,
I can see
and
it,
sprayed the
I
bugs?
I can see it doing that.
Wow.
Wait, what year was that?
It was in the 50s. I think like 50s.
I remember
the Orkin commercials.
And I'm sure they moved into the 60s with probably the same mascot.
They're
now it's
around.
I think just a guy with like the Orkin, you know, like... red diamond hat or something like that.
Yeah, but so that's two out of three.
There
you did
go.
A great job.
Really
yeah, you did a great job. Really.
I should have guessed I could have been the first one.
Could have.
Then the balloons would have come out of the ceiling.
Exactly.
Oh, so many.
Exactly. And the champagne bottles would pop and all of that.
Yes.
You did really well.
Thank you, Ivan, and thank you so much for being on The Morning After.
Pleasure. It's fun.
Do you have a Twitter handle or Instagram?
Yeah,
or anything?
Check out my Instagram at Ramen Junkie, and Twitter is at Ivan Ramen. So I'd love to have people take a look. I get some pretty good food porn going on there, and
we're big fans of that.
Yeah, no, it's fun. It's especially when I do these crazy Tokyo trips, and I go on like these crazy eating tears.
Any coming up?
I'm definitely going to be there for extended in the summer, and I'm going to try to get back in the next few weeks, but we'll see.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having.
Sari, always great to see you.
You as well.
This is The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.